from Washington. This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the threat of force to end the eastern Ukraine standoff. A summit seeks to rebuild Somalia's economy. We continue our conversation on the Global Youth Well-Being Index.
Roughly 85% of those youth represented in our index are actually living in countries with below average youth well-being.
And one former Palestinian prisoner may have found a better path to Middle East peace. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Ukraine's government threatened today to use force against pro-Russian activists who have seized a security services building in the eastern city of Luhansk. But there are also signs that the standoff might be resolved peacefully and that international tensions over Ukraine could also be eased. VOA's Al Pessin is monitoring the situation from London.
Ukraine's Interior Minister Arsen Avakov said his forces are engaged in an anti-terrorist operation in eastern Ukraine and that pro-Russian militants who want conflict will get a forceful answer. But the minister also said there's still time for dialogue. He predicted the situation in Luhansk would be resolved within 48 hours. The force inside the city's security services building has access to a supply of rifles and grenades. It is supported by several hundred protesters outside, guarding a growing barricade of tires, sandbags, and wooden crates, and armed with firebombs. There were reported to be talks underway, and the militants let 50 people leave the building. The government says they were hostages. The militants say they were protesters who wanted to go home. A protest leader called on Russian President Vladimir Putin for help.
Господин Путин, пожалейте своих бойцов.
The man, who identified himself only as Vitaly and said he is the protest commander, said if efforts to end the crisis fail, he wants help from Russia. The United States and NATO have warned against further Russian intervention in Ukraine after its annexation of the Crimea region. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry accused Russian provocateurs and agents of stirring up the recent series of protests in several eastern Ukraine cities. The area is near the Russian border and has a substantial ethnic Russian population. Russia has been staging a military exercise on its side of the border with a large number of troops that Western military experts say could easily become an invasion force. Western officials have said they will increase economic and diplomatic sanctions against Russia if it sends forces into eastern Ukraine. But a Russian foreign ministry spokesman said Wednesday the United States and Ukraine have no reason to be worried. At the same time, there were signs that the local and international tension could be eased later this week when Secretary Kerry is to meet with his Russian and Ukrainian counterparts. The plan announced Wednesday could be particularly significant because Russia has refused to meet with top officials of Ukraine's interim government since the overthrow of the former pro-Russian president in February. Also on Wednesday, the European Union created what it calls a support group for Ukraine to provide financial, technical, and political assistance. EU Commission President José Manuel Barroso said the move is evidence that the European Union stands by Ukraine. The Ukrainian interim prime minister has signed the political parts of an association agreement with the EU, leaving the economic sections for the future elected government. It's the same agreement that the former Ukrainian president refused to sign, sparking protests that led to his overthrow through a vote in parliament after weeks of large-scale protests and a violent crackdown against them. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Russia's annexation of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula has placed the spotlight on NATO. VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnera takes a look at NATO's response to the current crisis over Crimea and eastern Ukraine.
Experts say Russia's military incursion into Ukraine and its annexation of Crimea was a wake-up call for the 28-member NATO alliance. Charles Kupchin, NATO expert at Georgetown University, says since the end of the Cold War, the Western alliance has been trying to redefine its mission.
A few months ago, people were talking about an existential crisis for the alliance in the absence of the mission in Afghanistan. The bulk of NATO troops are scheduled to be out by the end of 2014. And the question was, okay, what next? And now I think there is a revival of NATO's traditional mission of collective defense.
That policy stipulates that an attack on one member is an attack on all of them. During a recent NATO meeting, Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen reaffirmed the alliance's commitment to collective defense, saying, "We will deter and defend against any threat."
We have already reinforced NATO's presence on the eastern borders of the alliance. We are flying AWACS surveillance patrols over Poland and Romania. We have more than doubled the number of fighter aircraft allocated to the NATO air policing mission in the Baltic states.
Poland and Romania are NATO members that border Ukraine on the west. Russia has amassed thousands of troops on its border with Ukraine, prompting Western experts to say an incursion into eastern Ukraine is likely. Charles Kupchin says NATO would react even more to protect its members.
You would see a considerable expansion in the moves that NATO has already taken to beef up defenses on its eastern frontier, perhaps even including reneging on the gentleman's agreement that was struck when Central European members entered NATO, which was to say to the Russians, we will not forward deploy substantial numbers of NATO troops in Central Europe.
Kupchin says NATO's reaction will be short of war.
The prospect of a clash between NATO forces and Russia over Ukraine is effectively out of the question. And that's because there has been an assessment on this side of the Atlantic as well as in Europe that what has happened and what could potentially happen in Eastern Ukraine is not the stuff of war. That is to say, war between the Western democracies and Russia.
Sean Kay, NATO expert at Ohio Wesleyan University, agrees. But he says Russian forces will have a difficult time if they enter eastern Ukraine.
There's not a lot we can do to stop them, but their military capabilities are actually still pretty thin. They can do a thing like the Georgia War, but that was a pretty small conflict with highly trained and integrated forces. But to sustain a large deployment of forces over a very long period of time in a hostile territory, that's going to be difficult for the Russians to do.
Charles Kupchin puts it this way.
For Putin to head into eastern Ukraine, he opens a Pandora's box. He risks a civil war on his border. He risks miring Russian troops in something that could look like another Afghanistan.
As a result of Russia's military intervention in Crimea, NATO has suspended all civilian and military cooperation with Moscow. NATO officials say they will review their relationship with Moscow in view of Russia's actions. Andre Dineshner, VOA News, Washington.
Ukraine's Petro Poroshenko, a self-made confectionery magnate worth an estimated $1.3 billion, has emerged as the frontrunner in opinion polls leading up to Ukraine's presidential election scheduled for May. The surveys show the one-time foreign minister well ahead of his main rival, former Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko. Henry Ridgewell profiles the man who has pledged to rescue Ukraine's economy and face down Russia.
Petro Poroshenko is known as the Chocolate King in Ukraine, having built a fortune on confectionery, but he is no stranger to politics. He was a regular speaker at Kiev's Independence Square at the height of the recent protests, denouncing corruption and calling for membership of the European Union. Arisia Lutsevich is at the London-based policy institute Chatham House.
He became so popular during the recent protest because he was giving some kind of confidence in terms of his direct action and also because he was not affiliated with the existing political parties.
Poroshenko has received the backing of opposition leader and former boxer Vitali Klitschko. In a recent interview, Poroshenko said he would build on Ukraine's revolution.
It was born the new country. It was born the new people. But unfortunately, it left old politician. And I try to do my best that the politician, the government, the authorities, and the president be adequate to the new people from the revolution.
Poroshenko played a big role in the Orange Revolution in 2004, alongside his now rival Yulia Tymoshenko, becoming foreign minister under the then president Viktor Yushchenko. He built his fortune on the back of his giant chocolate company, Roshen, alongside media and manufacturing interests. Observers say he is cultivating an image as a safe pair of hands.
You can come here in a very safe, in a very nice country, yeah, with a very experienced labor, with a very effective cheap cost for the creation of the businesses. And the only obstacle for doing that is the corruption. That's why it's a top priority during the modernization.
His status as a self-made billionaire sets him apart from Ukraine's other business elites, who are often seen as corrupt, says Arisia Lutsevich of Chatham House.
He has good understanding of the way international financial markets are working, and he is on good term basis with a lot of Western politicians. But also, you know, he is somebody who understands Russia, because he's doing a lot of his business with the confectionery and sugar industries are in Russia.
But Poroshenko's relations with the Kremlin are poor, says Russia specialist Andrew Foxall of analyst group the Henry Jackson Society.
His Russian confectionery business was subject to trade sanctions and embargoes by the Russian government. The business lost an awful lot of money. He lost an awful lot of money. More recently, Poroshenko's assets in Russia have been targeted.
Petro Poroshenko has said he will never accept Russia's forceful annexation of Crimea. Russia has deployed tens of thousands of troops along the Ukrainian border. Whoever wins the May 25th election, victory will mark just the beginning of the daunting challenges that face Ukraine's next leader. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
For years, Somalia has been referred to as a failed state, synonymous with piracy, poverty, and terrorism. Recent improvements in national security, however, have led to growing optimism that the country could finally be taking steps towards lasting stability. Somali officials say a stronger economy is vital to prolonged peace, and this week traveled to the United Arab Emirates with the hope of attracting foreign investment to the war-torn nation. Philip Walter Wellman reports from Dubai.
Participants at the Somali Investment Summit in Dubai painted a different picture of the East African country than the one the world has become familiar with.
If in past years the image was hunger, piracy, terrorism, today if you will see a different scenario. You will see a light at the end of the tunnel. You will see hope and that life is coming back. So this is the image we now want to show.
That was Ali Mohamed Gedi, the former prime minister of Somalia's transitional federal government. Growing stability in Somalia, which is grappling with a two-decade-old civil war, can largely be attributed to outside intervention. Over the past year, African Union troops helped drive al-Shabaab militants from major cities, and out at sea, international naval patrols led to a significant decrease in pirate attacks. But Getty warns that the outcome of these efforts could be short-lived unless more is done to address the underlying problem of poverty among the Somali population.
The young generation who have been employed by al-Shabaab, they are not ideologically radicalists, but for their survival. So if we create jobs for them, I believe that they play a role in the stabilization and the security of the country.
Hassan Dude, the chairman of the Somali Economic Forum, agrees that the lure of illegal activity, and especially piracy, will always be great when employment opportunities do not exist. He says attracting investment to Somalia now, when the security situation is improving, is crucial, as it will create jobs and help promote safety not only in the country, but throughout the region.
I think what the international organizations and international community is starting to realize is that bringing troops to Somalia will not be the answer to this problem. When people have jobs and you know, better life, of course, they will be less likely to get in trouble.
While conditions in Somalia have been improving, they're by no means ideal for investors. In addition to safety threats and the lack of a central government, corruption is rife and there's an absence of a skilled workforce. There is also no secure legal framework for foreign investors, although authorities are reportedly in the process of forming new legislation.
Investors are a bit afraid of actually going into situations like that, but there's a huge opportunity.
the GDP growth of Somalia is equal to Ethiopia. It's actually higher than some of the stable African countries. Somalia is growing. The economy is growing.
That was Hirsi Darir, the CEO of Dahabshiil Bank, which operates 130 branches in the country. Analysts say Somalia has substantial potential natural resources, including agriculture, livestock, fishing, and hydrocarbons. Its telecommunications sector is also expected to attract future investors. Although an increase in stability has led to a growing number of investments from overseas, overall activity remains weak. The United Arab Emirates, Oman, and Yemen are the leading investing nations in Somalia. This is Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
We reported to you Monday about the Global Youth Well-Being Index that measures and compares the quality of life for young people in 30 nations. Today, we continue our conversation with the director of the study, Nicole Golden, about what was lacking in the lowest-ranked nation, Nigeria.
Nigeria, one of the things that we've seen is, and Nigeria, I shouldn't say, isn't alone, and some of the other countries and towards the bottom of the ranks, the bottom ranks do tend to be filled with some of the lower income economies. And a number of the indicators are infrastructure oriented or systems, you know, system services oriented, where we know low income countries are less likely to do well than the more wealthy nations. At the same time, we also do see some negative outlook, a more consistent negative outlook among young Nigerians that also contribute to bringing down their scores and bringing down their ranks.
Is there anything that you have deduced from your findings so far?
A number of things that really struck us in terms of looking at the overall scores as well as within the different domains. I mean, the first thing is that the 30 countries that we do cover in this inaugural index represent or host about 70% of the world's young people, so fairly significant numbers in these 30 countries. And what we find is that roughly 85% of those youth represented in our index are actually living in countries with below average youth well-being. So it's pretty significant. And again, it's the emerging economies, the developing economies, the more fragile states that tend to have the largest youth populations. One of the other interesting things that we find is that, importantly, is that even where young people are doing relatively well, as I said, those countries towards the top and in the upper ranks, there are specific challenges that that they see and that they face and that, you know, we're hoping can be better addressed now that they're brought to light through our index. So, for example, there's a global youth unemployment crisis, really, that's affecting countries worldwide. And in particular, Europe has been very hard hit. So countries like Spain, who does, you know, quite well in the overall rankings, really falls when it comes to economic opportunity. So that's interesting. And at the same time, conversely, we see even where young people are not doing necessarily well overall, they are thriving in certain respects, and I think I have some important lessons learned to be shared. So again, for example, in the area of what we call citizen participation, which is our area that looks at measures of civic and political expression, Colombia is tops the ranks, followed by India and South Africa and Tanzania, countries that don't necessarily perform well overall on youth well-being, but really show a good framework and a good opportunity for young people to engage, and as well as some nice optimism from young people in this respect. So it's really some of the most interesting things we see. One other thing I'll mention is that in terms of sort of across the 30 countries looking globally, what we find is that on average, countries, young people are doing better in health and least well in terms of economic opportunity. Again, the economic opportunity piece, not necessarily so surprising given the unemployment crisis and the fact that young people were really so hard hit by the global recession. But the health was quite an interesting finding in that really two-thirds of the countries scoring, you know, well above average on the health indicators. showing that I think a lot of the global investments that have been made in disease prevention, in reducing HIV, in childhood nutrition, are paying off for young people. I mean, there's still a ways to go, and there are still gaps, but that was something interesting and positive that we were glad to see.
Nicole Golden, Director of the Youth Prosperity and Security Initiative for the Center for Strategic and International Studies and the International Youth Foundation. You can see details of the report by visiting youthindex.org. The protracted Middle East peace process is in danger of stalling yet again as Israel reneged on the planned release of another batch of Palestinian prisoners and the Palestinians renewed their bid to gain United Nations recognition of a Palestinian state. One former Palestinian prisoner may have found a better path to peace. After spending more than 20 years in an Israeli prison, he now teaches Hebrew to Palestinian children in the West Bank. Zladysa Hoke has that story for VOA Television.
In a classroom of Palestinian 10th graders in the town of Taibe, Ismat Mansour encourages his students to discuss the advantages of learning Hebrew, the language he learned while serving a 22-year prison term in Israel. He was among dozens of Palestinian prisoners who were granted an early release last year in a deal brokered by the United States. Mansour was sentenced to prison as a 16-year-old for helping three older teenagers stab to death an Israeli settler in 1993.
When I was released, I passed in front of the place where the event took place, the killing of the settler. I felt that I had closed the circle at this point, and now I have started a new cycle of my life as a free person who suffered for a long time. I lived through a very hard experience, but this made me gain insight and a belief in the Palestinian cause, but more importantly, that justice should be carried out in a humane and a just way.
Mansour says Palestinians and Israelis need to engage in a debate to resolve their long-time conflict. He says Palestinians will be better equipped if they understand Hebrew, the dominant language of Jews living in Israel and the occupied Palestinian territories. Mansour says he would never again resort to killing, but that he has no regrets.
The real violence here is the violence of occupation. It forces us to resort to violence. I don't feel regret for what I had done, because there was an expression of my thoughts at that age and an expression of the political conditions at the time, but I would not do that now.
Many Israelis are not convinced, especially those whose family and friends fell victim to violence. Itzik Mizrahi's brother Haim was 30 when he was killed in the 1993 murder in which Mansour was an accomplice. Mizrahi is one of those who oppose his government's decision to release Palestinian prisoners.
Every time that prisoners are released, we feel that they can continue their lives. They can build a house, a family, get money on a regular basis. But we remain without my brother. My brother did not get to see his own daughter. They can raise children of their own. We are the only ones who have lost. Only my brother lost.
Israel-Palestinian talks have again run into hurdles as the sides cannot agree on several crucial issues, including the release of Palestinian prisoners. Mansour is working with a group of West Bank journalists to establish a website in which he would cover Israeli affairs. He also is hoping to start a weekly radio show about the Israeli economy. Zladysa Hoek, VOA News, Washington.
The Connecticut Huskies won the U.S. Women's College Basketball Championship with a 79-58 win over Notre Dame in Nashville, Tennessee. The win capped another history-making season for the Huskies since head coach Gino Armea took over the program in 1985. Connecticut now has 9 National Collegiate Athletic Association titles and finished the season with 40 consecutive wins and no losses for its 5th undefeated season. Brianna Stewart, the National Player of the Year, led the Huskies with 21 points and 9 rebounds, while teammate Stephanie Dawson finished with 17 points and 16 rebounds. The Irish were also undefeated heading into the title game with 37 straight wins, marking the first matchup of two undefeated teams in the women's title game. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day at our website at voanews.com. That's voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.